The Beechcraft bucked suddenly and dropped a wing. Instinctively, Johnny corrected the lunge with stick and rudder, then glanced quickly at his instrument panel for an explanation. There was none to be found there, so he looked over the wing and for the first time noticed the dust on the great plains below him. It was moving low against the earth in long streamers like mist, and the setting sun turned it to mauve and old gold. With a prickle of alarm, he scanned the horizon ahead and saw it coming down from the north like a great moving range of blue mountains. Even as he watched it, it rolled across the low sun, turning it into a sullen red orb. The light in the cockpit changed to a weird glow, as though the door to a furnace had been thrown open. Again, the Beechcraft crabbed awkwardly as another gust of high wind hit her, and at the same moment the radio crackled and came alive. "Zulu Sugar Peter Tango Baker, this is Alexandra Bay Control. Come in, please." The voice of the controller was almost unintelligible with storm static. Johnny reached for the transmit switch of the radio, then stopped his hand. He thought quickly. He could guess they were trying to reach him to cancel his flight approval. That was a Big Northern boiling down out of the desert. They would abort his flight and divert him out of the path of the storm. He checked his wristwatch. 20 minutes flying time to Cartridge Bay. No, he was flying full into the eye of the wind, say 25 or 30 minutes. Quickly he searched the coast on his port side and saw the long white lines of surf stretched ahead into the thickening purple gloom. The coast was still clear. It might stay that way for another 30 minutes. "Zulu Sugar Peter Tango Baker, this is Alexandra Bay. I say again, come in. Come in, Zulu Sugar Peter Tango Baker." The agitation in the controller's voice came through over the static. There was a fair chance of getting into Cartridge Bay, racing the storm and winning. He could edge out to the westward and come in from the sea, pick up Kingfisher's riding lights as a beacon, and sneak in under the leading edge of the dust clouds. If he missed, he could turn and run with the wind for home. The radio was hissing and crackling angrily now, the controller's voice sometimes lost in the interference, sometimes coming through strongly. "Cancelled, I say again, your flight approval is cancelled. Do you read me, Sugar, Zulu, Peter, Tango, Baker? Come in, please. Come in, Beaufort 47. Visibility in the storm area. I say again, there is nil visibility." The norther would roar for days now, and with it would blow away his last chance of working the gap at Thunderbolt and suicide. Johnny switched off the radio, cut off contact with control, and immediately it was strangely quiet in the cockpit. He settled himself down into the bucket seat and eased open the throttles, watching the needles creep up around the dials of the rev counters. Now he was down to an altitude of 300 feet, and the Beechcraft was leaping about like a hooked marlin. He was flying her on instruments, for outside the cockpit it was completely dark. He could not see his own wingtips, but above him the stars still showed. He was riding the vanguard of the storm, and the dust clouds were ahead, racing to meet him and blanket the flare path at Cartridge Bay. Every few seconds he darted a quick glance ahead, hoping to pick up the lights. Then his eyes flew back to the instrument panel. "Now," he thought grimly, "it should be now. I should be over the grounds. 30 seconds more and I'll know I've missed her." He looked up again, and there was Kingfisher dead ahead. All her lights were ablaze, a burning beacon of hope in the darkness. She appeared to be riding easily, for the wind had not yet had time to thrash the sea into a frenzy. He flashed over her, seeming to graze her superstructure in passing, and now he was searching anxiously for the glow of the flare path on the land beyond. It came up as a path of lesser darkness in the absolute blackness of the night. He steadied on course towards it, watching it change to a long double line of oil-burning flares that smoked and fluttered in the wind. He flew her in fast, high above the stall, and the shock of touchdown threatened to tear the undercarriage off her. Then he was jolting and trundling down the earthen runway with the flares flashing past his wingtips. "Lance, old man," he murmured thankfully, "that was a very shaky do." The wind hum against the body of the car and the snarl of rubber on tarmac as the Mercedes snaked through the bends of the twisting mountain road were sounds to match the racing of Tracy's blood and the hammer of her heart. She drove with an inspired abandon, watching the bends leap out at her out of the darkness, sensing the massive crags and cliffs that hung over the road and blotted out half the night sky. The silver sheet of Clan William Lake reflected the stars and then was left behind. Down from the mountains she went and over the Olifants River to make a brief fuel stop at Von Reinsdorp and scan the road map anxiously in the light of the gasoline pumps. She read with a sinking feeling the mileage figures printed along the little red ribbon of the road and knew that for her each mile would be multiplied by her own urgency. Then, once more behind the wheel, she faced the vast emptiness of Namaqualand and sent the Mercedes flying across it. "There's some type of machine. I don't know how it works, but it filters out the diamonds. Benedict had it installed at Las Palmas." The headlights were puny like white shafts, and the road a long blue smear that went on endlessly. Tracy lit a cigarette with one hand, hearing Ruby's voice again in her ears. "There's one diamond amongst them. He called it the Big Blue. Benedict says it's worth $1 million. Tracy was not sure she believed it. It was the enormity of the treachery and deceit that she could not accept. "The Italian, the captain, be careful of him. He works for Benedict. The other one also, Hugo. They are all in it. Warn Johnny." Benedict. Weak, spoiled Benedict the playboy, the spendthrift. Could he have planned and carried this through? A gust of wind hit the car from the side, taking her unawares, pushing the Mercedes off the tar onto the gravel. Tracy fought to hold the skid. Dust and gravel roared out in a cloud from under the wheels. Then she was back on the road, hurtling northwards. Warn Johnny! Warn Johnny! Benedict van der Bael sat in his father's chair in his father's house, and he was alone. His loneliness ate deep into the fibres of his whole being. Before him, on the stinkwood desk, stood a crystal glass and a decanter. The brandy was no comfort. Its warmth in his throat and belly seemed only to accentuate the icy cold of his loneliness. His fantasy showed him as a hollow man. He thought of himself as a husk, filled only with the cold of melancholia. He looked about the room with its dark panelled woodwork, and he smelled the musty dead smell. He wondered how many times his father had sat in this chair, alone and lonely, lonely and afraid as the cancer ate him alive. He stood up and moved listlessly about the room, touching the furniture as if he were trying to communicate with the man who had lived and died here. He moved across and stood in front of the curtained windows. The rug was new. It replaced the other that they had been unable to clean. "The old man had the right idea," he spoke aloud, his voice sounding strange in his own ears. Then, on an impulse, he crossed quickly to the cupboard that flanked the massive stone fireplace and tried the door. It was locked. Without passion, he stood back and kicked in the panel. The wood splintered, and he kicked again, smashing the door from its hinges. The oblong leather case was on the top shelf, and he took it down and carried it to the desk. He sprang the catches and laid back the lid. He lifted out the blue metal double barrels of the Purdy Royal, and the gun oil was greasy on his hands. "Jacobus Isaac van der Bael," he read aloud the name, in gold inlay, set into the steel among the engraved pheasants and gun dogs. He smiled then. "The old devil," he shook his head, smiling, as though at some private joke, and began slowly to assemble the shotgun. He weighed it in his hands, feeling the sweet, pure balance of the weapon. The old bastard made his own decisions. And still smiling, he carried the gun across to the new carpet. He placed it butt down between his feet, with the barrels pointed at the ceiling, and leaning slowly forward, he opened his mouth and placed the muzzles between his lips. Then, reaching further down, he placed a thumb on each trigger and pushed them simultaneously. Click, click! The firing pins fell on the empty chambers, and Benedict straightened up and wiped the taste of gun oil from his lips. He grinned again. That's the way he did it. Both barrels in the back of the throat. What a cure for tonsils, he chuckled, and glanced across at the shattered cupboard door. The square packets of cartridges were on the second shelf. He tucked the gun under his arm and went to the cupboard again, moving more purposefully now. He snatched down a packet of SSG and broke it open. Suddenly his hands were shaking, and the fat red cartridges spilled onto the floor. He stooped and picked up two of them. With mounting excitement and dread, he broke open the shotgun and slipped the cartridges into the blank eyes of the breeches. They slid home against the seating with a solid double thunk, and he hurried back to the spot in front of the window. His eyes were bright and his breathing quick as he pushed the safety catch onto fire and placed the butt between his feet once more. He took the muzzles in his mouth again in an obscene soul kiss and reached down for the triggers. They were cold and oily. He caressed them lightly, feeling the fine grooving in the curves of metal, thrilling to the touch and feel of them, as he had never thrilled to the feel of a woman's body. Then abruptly he stood up again. He was gasping for breath. Unsteadily he carried the weapon back to the desk and laid it on the dark polished wood. As he poured brandy into the crystal glass, his eyes were fastened with perverse fascination on the beautiful glistening weapon. The steam had fogged the mirrored walls of the bathroom, so her image was dewed and misty. Ruby Lance dried herself slowly with one of the thick, fluffy towels. She was in no hurry. She wanted Tracy to have a start of at least 4 hours on her journey to Cartridge Bay. With a deep narcissistic pleasure, she noticed in the mirrors how her whole body glowed with soft pink highlights from the hot waters of the bath. Wrapping herself in the towel, she went through into the dressing room and, picking up one of the silverback brushes, began stroking it through her hair, moving across to the open wardrobe to select a dress for the occasion. It must be something special, perhaps the unworn, full-length Louis Ferreau of daffodil satin. Still undecided, she went back to seat herself at the dressing table and began the complicated ritual of applying her makeup. She worked with meticulous care until at last she smiled at her reflection with satisfaction. She dropped the towel, went back to the wardrobe, and stood slim and naked before it. Pouting slightly with concentration, she decided against the Ferreau. Then suddenly she smiled and reached for Benedict's mink. She wrapped herself in the pale cloud of fur, fluffing up the collar to frame her face. It was perfect. Just the fur and a pair of golden slippers, pale gold, a perfect match for her hair. Now suddenly she was eager to go. She ran from the house to where her car was parked in the driveway. She switched off the headlights as she turned into the driveway that curved up to where the old house crouched on the top of Weinberg Hill. The whisper of the engine was unobtrusive and blended with the whimper of the night breeze in the chestnut trees that flanked the driveway. She parked in the courtyard and saw that Benedict's Rolls was still in the garage, and a light burned in the window of the study, a yellow oblong behind the curtains. The front door was open. Her slippered feet made no sound along the gloomy passages, and when she tried the door to the study, it swung open readily. She stepped into the room and closed the door behind her. She stood with her back to the dark panelled wood. A single shaded lamp lit the room dimly. Benedict sat behind the desk. The room was heavy with the smell of cigar smoke and brandy fumes. He had been drinking. His face was flushed, and the top button of his shirt was undone. On the desk in front of him lay a shotgun. Ruby was surprised at the presence of the weapon. It disconcerted her, and the words she had prepared were forgotten. Benedict looked up at her. His eyes were slightly unfocused, and he blinked slowly. Then he grinned. It twisted his mouth, and his voice, when he spoke, was slurred. "So you've come back." Instantly her hatred returned in full flood. But she kept her face impassive. "Yes," she agreed. "I've come back." "Come here." He swiveled his chair to the side of the desk. Ruby did not move. She leaned back against the door. "Come here." Benedict's voice was stronger now, and suddenly Ruby smiled and obeyed. She stood in front of him, huddled in the fur. "Kneel down," commanded Benedict, and she hesitated. "Down," his voice crackled. "Down, damn you." Ruby sank to her knees in front of him, and he straightened up in the chair. She knelt in front of him in the attitude of submission, with her head forward so the golden hair hung like a curtain over her face. "Say it," he gloated. "Ask me to forgive you." Slowly, she lifted her face and looked up at him. She spoke softly. "Tracy left for Cartridge Bay at 5:30 this evening." Benedict's expression changed. "She has a start of 4 hours. She's halfway there already." He stared at her with his lips parting, soft and red and slack. "She's going to Johnny," Ruby went on. She knows about the thing in Kingfisher. She knows about the big blue diamond. He began to shake his head in disbelief. By dawn tomorrow, Johnny will know also. So you see, my darling, you've lost again, haven't you? You can never beat him, can you, Benedict? Can you, my darling? Her voice was rising, ringing with triumph. You, he croaked. You. And she laughed, nodding her head in agreement, unable to speak through her laughter. Benedict lunged clumsily out of the chair, his hands going for her throat. She went over backwards with him on top of her. Her laughter died gurgling in her throat. They rolled together on the floor, Benedict's hands locked on her neck, his voice rising in a scream of fury and despair. Her long legs kicking and thrashing, clawing at his face and hands, she fought him with the strength of a cornered animal. They rolled back suddenly, and Benedict's head struck the solid leg of the desk with a crack that jarred his whole body. His grip on her throat loosened, and she tore herself free with fresh breath hissing into her open mouth. She rolled away from him, and in one fluid movement gained her feet, reeling back from him with the front of the mink torn open and her hair tangled across her face. Benedict dragged himself up the desk onto his knees. He was still screaming, a high, keening note without form or coherence, as Ruby spun away from him and stumbled to the door. Blinded by her own hair, fighting for strangled breath, she fumbled for the door handle with her back turned to him. Benedict reached up and lifted the shotgun off the desk. Still kneeling beside the desk, he held the weapon across his hip. The recoil was a liquid, pulsing jolt in his hands, and the muzzle blast was thunderous in the confines of the room, the long yellow flame lighting the scene like a photographer's flash bulb. The heavy charge caught Ruby in the small of her back. At that range, there was no spread of shot, and it went through spine and pelvis in a solid, shattering ball. It tore out through the front of her belly, spinning her sideways along the wall. She slid down into a sitting position, facing him with the mink flared open about her. On his knees, Benedict swung the gun to follow her fall, and he fired the second barrel. Again, the brief thunder and flame of the muzzle blast flashed across the room. At even closer range than the first charge, it struck her full in her beautiful golden face. Benedict stood in the garage with his forehead pressed against the cold metal of the Rolls-Royce. The shotgun was still in his hands, and his pockets were crammed with cartridges that he had picked up from the floor before leaving the study. He was shivering violently like a man in high fever. No, he moaned to himself, repeating the single negative over and over again, leaning against the big car. Abruptly he gagged, remembering the carnage he had created. Then he retched, still leaning against the rolls, bringing up the brandy mingled with his horror. It left him pale and weak, but steadier. Through the open window he threw the gun onto the back seat of the rolls and climbed shakily into the driver's seat. He sat there, bowed over the steering wheel, and now his instinct of self-preservation took hold of him. It seemed to him there was but one avenue of escape still open to him. Wild Goose had the range to take him across an ocean, South America perhaps, and there was money in Switzerland. He started the rolls and reversed out of the garage, the spin of tyres against concrete burning blue smoke into the beams of the headlights. Tracy's Mercedes crawled through the thick sand, the headlights probing ineffectually into the bright orange fog of dust that whipped endlessly over the track ahead. The hot, gritty wind buffeted the car, rocking it on its suspension. Tracy sat forward in the driver's seat, peering ahead through the eyes that felt raw and swollen with fatigue and mica dust. From the main road to the coast, this jeep track was the only land access to Cartridge Bay. It was 100 miles of tortuous trail, made up of deep sandy ruts and broken stone where it crossed one of the many rocky ridges. The radiator of the Mercedes was boiling furiously, overheating in the searing wind and the slogging low-gear grind through thick sand. In places, Tracy followed the track only by driving through gaps in the stunted knee-high growth of desert bush. Every few minutes, a tumbleweed, driven by the wind, would bowl across the track like a frightened furry animal. At times she was sure she had missed a turning, and was now grinding aimlessly out into the desert. Then reassuringly the twin ruts would show up in the lights ahead of her. Once she did drive off the road, and immediately the Mercedes came to a gentle standstill, with its rear wheels spinning helplessly in the soft sand. She had to climb out of the cab, and with her bare hands scoop away the sand from behind the wheels, and stuff bundles of tumbleweed into the depressions to give the wheels purchase. She almost wept with relief when the Mercedes pulled back sluggishly onto the trail again. The slow dawn broke through the dust clouds, and Tracy switched off the headlights and drove on, until suddenly and quite unexpectedly she reached Cartridge Bay. The depot buildings loomed suddenly before her, and she left the Mercedes and ran to the living quarters. The foreman opened the door to her insistent hammering and stared at her in astonishment before ushering her in. Tracy cut off his questions with her own. "Where's Wild Goose?"
"She took Mr. Lance out to Kingfisher. But she's back now, lying at the jetty."
"Hugo Kramer, the captain?"
"He's aboard, holed up in his cabin."
"Thanks." Tracy left him, pushed the door open against the wind, and ran out into the storm. Wild Goose lay at her moorings, secured by heavy lines to the bollards, but fidgeting and fretting at the push of the wind. There was a gangplank laid to her deck, and lights showed at her portholes. Tracy went aboard. Hugo Kramer came to the doorway of his cabin in a suit of rumpled striped pyjamas. Tracy pushed past him.
"You took Lance out to Kingfisher," she accused him, her voice sharp and anxious.
"Yes."
"You idiot! Didn't you realize there was something up? Good God! Why otherwise would he fly in through this weather?"
Hugo stared at her, and instinctively she knew that what Ruby had told her was true.
"I don't know what you are talking about," he blurted. "You'll know all right when we're all sitting behind bars. We'll have 15 long years to think about it. Lance has tumbled to it, you fool. I've got to stop him. Take me out to Kingfisher."
He was confused and afraid.
"I know nothing about..." Hugo started again. "You're wasting time."
Brusquely, Tracy brushed his protest aside.
"Take me out to Kingfisher." "Your brother, where is he? Why didn't he come?"
Tracy had anticipated the question.
"Lance beat him up, badly. He's in hospital. He sent me."
Suddenly Hugo was convinced.
"Got," he swore. "What are we going to do? The storm. I may be able to get you out there, but I won't be able to leave Wild Goose. My crew can't handle her in the sea. What can you do on your own?" "Just get me out there," said Tracy. "Get me aboard Kingfisher, and you can come back. The Italian Caporetti, he and I will take care of Lance. In this storm, a man can be washed overboard very easily."
"Yah!"
Hugo's face lit with relief. "That's it! The Italian!" And he reached for his oilskins hanging on the bulkhead. As he pulled them on over his pyjamas, he looked at Tracy with new respect.
"You!" he said. "I didn't know you were in it."
"Did you think my brother and I would stand by and let a stranger take our birthright from us?"
Hugo grinned.
"Hey, you are a cool one. I'll say that for you. You had me fooled."
And he went out onto the bridge. Johnny Lance and Sergio Caporetti stood shoulder to shoulder on Kingfisher's bridge. The ship was taking the big green seas over her bows, solid walls of water, and the wind-whipped spray that spattered the armoured glass windows of the bridge house. Kingfisher had slipped her moorings the previous evening, leaving the big yellow buoys floating on their anchor cables, and she was working free of her fetters. She was on computer navigation, holding her position over the ground against the swells and the wind by use of her engine and rudder.
"She is not good," Sergio spoke morosely. "We come too close to the rocks. I get sick in my heart looking at them."
The dust clouds did not carry this far out to sea, despite the vicious screeching of the wind. The visibility was a mile or more, quite enough to show the brooding twin hulks of Thunderbolt and Suicide. The storm-crazed swells burst against them, throwing white spray 200 feet into the gloomy sky, then surging back to expose the gleaming white rock.
"Hold her," growled Johnny.
Twice during the night they had changed position, each time edging down closer on the gap between the two islands. Kingfisher was battling gamely to hold her ground against the insidious sucking current that added its pull to that of the swell and the wind. Johnny was not attempting to work any one of the gullies extensively. He wanted only to sample as much of the field as possible in the time that was left to him. The storm would not stop him, for Kingfisher was constructed to work in worse weather than this. Her compensating hose section was keeping the dredgehead on the bottom, despite the lift and fall of her hull.
"Calm down, Sergio," Johnny relented a little.
The computer is foolproof. The goddamn computer, she not got eyes to see these rocks. Me, I got eyes, and it gives me a sicker heart.
Twice during the night, Johnny had gone down into the control room and ordered the computer to report its recovery of diamonds. Each time the reply had been consistent. Not a single stone over 4 carats, and a very precious few of any others.
I'm going through to the plot. Watch her, Johnny told Sergio.
And staggering against the pitch and roll, he went through the door behind the bridge. He paused behind the repeater screen of the computer and at a glance saw that Kingfisher was holding her primary operation and all departments were running normally. He passed the screen and leaned over the chart table. The large-scale chart of the southwest African coast between Luderitz and Walvis Bay was pinned down on the board. The wild goose soundings were penciled in, and the pattern of Kingfisher's sweeps were carefully plotted around the islands of Thunderbolt and Suicide. Johnny picked up a pair of dividers and stared moodily at the chart. Suddenly a surge of anger rose in him against those two names. They had promised so much and delivered so little. He stared at the names Thunderbolt and Suicide, printed in italics among the maze of soundings, and his anger turned to blind red hatred. With the points of the dividers, he slashed at the chart, ripping the thick linen paper once and twice in a ragged cross-shaped tear. This small act of violence dissipated his anger. He felt embarrassed. It had been a petty, childish gesture. He tried to smooth the edges of the tear, and through the gap, he felt another loose scrap of paper, which someone had slipped under the chart. He probed a finger through the tear in the chart and wormed the scrap out. He glanced at the scribbled title and the lines of figures and numbers that followed. The sheet was headed Kaminakoto's Secondary Recovery Program. He studied it, puzzled by the title but recognizing the numbers as a computer program. The writing was in Sergio Caporetti's pointed continental style. The easiest way to resolve the mystery was to ask Sergio. Johnny started back for the bridge.
"Hey, boss," Sergio called anxiously as Johnny stepped through the door. "Hey, look!"
He was pointing ahead into the eye of the wind. Johnny hurried to his side, the paper crumpled and forgotten in his hand.
"Wild goose," Sergio identified the small craft that was staggering and plunging towards them out of the gloom. "What the hell is he doing here?" Johnny wondered aloud.
Wild goose was lost for long seconds behind the walls of green sea. Then again she was lifted high into unnatural prominence, showing the red lead of her bottom as she rode the crests. Water poured from her scuppers before she shot down the steep slope of the next wave to bury her nose deep in frothing water. She came down swiftly on the wind, rounding to and beginning to edge in under Kingfisher's counter.
"What the hell is he playing at?" Johnny protested.
And then, in disbelief, he saw a slim figure dart from Wild Goose's wheelhouse and run to the side nearest Kingfisher.
"It's Tracy!" shouted Johnny.
She reached the rail just as another swell burst over the bows and smothered her. Johnny expected to see her washed away, but she was still there clinging to the rail. Thrusting the page of paper into his pocket, Johnny went out through the wing of the bridge and swarmed down the steel ladder to the deck, jumping the last 10 feet and running the instant he landed. He reached the side and looked down on the drowned kitten figure of Tracy.
"Go back!" he yelled. "Go back! Don't try it!"
She shouted something that was lost in the next smother of spray, and when it cleared he saw her poising herself to jump the gap of surging water between the two vessels. He flung himself over Kingfisher's side and climbed swiftly down the steel rungs. He was still 10 feet above her as she gathered herself for the leap.
"Go back!"
he shouted desperately. She jumped, missed her hold, and fell into the murderous stretch of water between the hulls. Her head bobbed below Johnny, and he was aware of the next swell bearing down on them. It would throw Wild Goose against the steel cliff of Kingfisher, crushing Tracy between them. Johnny went down those last 10 feet, and hanging outwards by one arm, he got his other arm around her, and with a heave that crackled in his muscles and joints, he plucked her from the water just as the two vessels dashed together with a crunching impact that tore splinters from Wild Goose's planking and left a smear of alien paint on Kingfisher's steel plating. Wild Goose swung away, and with her diesels bellowing, went bucking off into the wind. With puddles of seawater forming around her feet from her sodden clothing, Tracy stood in the centre of Kingfisher's guest cabin. Her dark hair was plastered down her face and neck, and she was shivering so violently from shock and the icy water that she could not talk. Her teeth chattered together, and her lips were blue with cold. Desperately, she was trying to form words, her eyes never leaving Johnny's face. Quickly, he stripped off her clothing, and throwing one towel around her shoulders, he began roughly to chafe warmth back into her with another. "You little idiot," he berated her. "Are you stark, staring, bloody mad?"
"Johnny,"
she gasped through her chattering teeth. "Christ, that was so close," he snarled at her, as he knelt to rub her legs.
"Johnny, listen."
"Shut up and dry your hair." Humbly, she obeyed him. Her shivers became controllable as he crossed to the locker and found a thick jersey which he pulled over her head. It hung almost to her knees. "Now," he said, taking her roughly by the shoulders, "what the hell is this all about?" And she told him in a rush of words that poured out like water from a broken dam. Then she burst into tears and stood there forlornly in the voluminous jersey with her damp hair dangling about her shoulders, sobbing as though her heart was breaking. Johnny took her in his arms. For a long minute, Tracy revelled in his warmth and strength. But she was the first to pull away.
"Do something, Johnny," she implored him, her voice still thick with tears. "Stop them. You mustn't let them get away with it."
He went back to the locker, and while he ransacked it for clothing that might fit her, Johnny's mind was racing over the story she had told him. He watched her pull on a pair of blue serge trousers and tie them at the waist with a length of cord. She folded back the cuffs and tucked them into thick woolen socks before thrusting her feet into a pair of sea boots that were only a few sizes too large for her.
"Where do we start?" she asked,
and he remembered the sheet of paper. He fished it out of his pocket and flattened it on the table beside the bunk. Quickly he ran his eyes over the columns of figures. His first guess was right. It was a computer program.
"Stay here," he ordered Tracy.
"No," her response was immediate. And he grinned. "Listen, I'm just going up on the bridge to keep them busy there. I'll come back for you, I promise. You won't miss anything."
"How is she, boss?" Sergio Caporetti's concern was genuine. Johnny realized that he must be worrying himself into a frenzy trying to guess the reason for Tracy's arrival.
"She's pretty shaken up," Johnny answered.
"What does she want? That was big chance she take. Nearly fish food, huh?"
"I don't know," Johnny said. "I want you to take over up here. Keep Kingfisher working. I'm going to get her to bed. I'll let you know what it's all about as soon as I find out."
"Okay, boss."
"Oh, and, Sergio, keep an eye on those rocks. Don't let her drift down any closer."
Johnny chose a powerful incentive to keep Sergio up on the bridge. Johnny left him and went below, stopping only at the guest cabin.
"Come on."
Tracy followed him, lurching unsteadily with Kingfisher's antics in the high sea. Two decks down, they reached the computer control room, and Johnny unlocked the heavy steel door, then locked it again behind them. Tracy wedged herself against the bulkhead and watched as Johnny seated himself at the console and clipped the rumpled sheet into the board. Reading from the sheet, he typed the first line of figures on the keyboard. Immediately, the computer registered a protest. "Operator error," it typed back. Johnny ignored its denial and typed the second line. This time it was more emphatic. "No procedure. Operator error." And Johnny typed the next line of figures. He guessed that whoever had stored this program in the computer's memory would have placed a series of blocks to prevent accidental discovery. Again the denial flashed back at him. "Operator error." And Johnny muttered, "Thrice before the cock crows," striking an incongruously biblical note in the tense atmosphere of the control room. He typed the last line of figures, and the denial faded from the screen. The console clicked like a monstrous crab, then suddenly it started to print again. "Kaminakoto Secondary Recovery Program, installed October 1969 at Las Palmas by Hideki Kaminakoto, Doctor of Science, Tokyo University." The little Japanese had been unable to resist autographing his masterpiece. Tracy and Johnny crouched over the screen, staring at it with awful fascination, as the computer began spelling out its report. It began with the number of hours worked and the weight of gravel processed during that time. Next, it reported the weight of concentrates recovered from the cyclone, and finally, in a series of columns, It printed out the weights and sizes of all the diamonds won from the sea. The big blue showed up in the place of honour, and wordlessly Tracy touched the figure 320 with a forefinger. Johnny nodded grimly. The computer ended by giving the grand total of carats recovered, and Johnny spoke for the first time.
"It's true," he said softly. "It doesn't seem possible, but it is."
The click and hum of the computer ceased, and the screen went blank. Johnny straightened up in the chair.
"Where would they put it?" he asked himself, as he ran quickly over the line of recovery.
He stood up from the chair and peered through the leaded glass peephole into the X-ray room.
"It must be this side of the cyclone, this side of the dryer," he was speaking aloud. "Between the dryer and the X-ray room."
Then there bobbed to the surface of memory the modification in design which he had meant to query, but which he had forgotten.
"The inspection plate on the conveyor tunnel!" He punched his fist into his palm. "They moved the inspection plate. That's it. It's in the conveyor tunnel."
His hands were frantic with haste as he unlocked the steel door of the control room.